Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:45 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is July 6th and it's been an eventful day. Certainly when we look at the oil market, it's down approximately $2.50, but that's a downside key day reversal. So we haven't had one of those in a while, and the key to the key is in size, and certainly it sticks out as being the largest downward dynamic that we've seen in months. And then it's also coming from a new recovery high, and it's closing below the low of the last 2 days at least. So it's a peak of at least near-term significance. Now, if it bounces back tomorrow, well, then that might argue that the signal has been countermanded. But if we get downside follow-through tomorrow, it would greatly enhance the potential that we're going to go back down and test the $70 at a minimum level, and then potentially the $60 area. That would be a full reversion back down towards the mean. A $15 decline on a $75 move would be a significant percentage decline. But one thing that we can think about is that there are these negotiations that are going on within OPEC and indeed OPEC Plus, including Russia. And then there's the question of when will Iran get back into get its production rights back through OPEC, and the whole question of sanctions. And the market is beginning to price in the potential that more supply is going to be coming into the market. You have the UAE saying that they want their allocation from OPEC to more accurately reflect their ability to produce. And that would represent an additional 1 million barrels a day if they were to get that allocation. So there is a lot to play for in terms of the oil price. And this has been one of the factors that has contributed to inflationary pressures. When you see that oil prices are up from $40 to $75 in the space of little more than about 8 months, well, then it's going to increase costs, and particularly for consumers, because it feeds directly through into gasoline prices. And of course, oil is a significant contributing factor in the cost of production for absolutely every other commodity. So it's been one of the key factors in stoking inflationary pressures. And the reality is that there isn't really any deficit. This is completely artificially introduced as a result of the uncertainty last year about demand. And as demand recovers, so will supply. There's no particular reason why oil prices need to surge higher. And it's quite likely that they're going to settle back into a comfortable region somewhere around the $60 to $70 area, which is probably comfortable for the majority of consumers and for the majority of producers. Now, we also had significant moves in here today in the government bond markets. There was a clear upward dynamic in UK gilts. Now, you have the Office of Budgetary Responsibility talking about the fact that the convexity of the market is now 6 times greater than it was before the financial or before the pandemic. And that is a clear reflection of the fact that the quantity of debt last year massively expanded, but because yields contracted and because there was so much demand for safe havens, that in fact the cost of servicing that excessive amount of debt decreased, and the cost of servicing the overall debt decreased last year. And that was probably it's reasonable to anticipate that that condition is unlikely to last. But certainly this was a clear upward dynamic. So it does suggest that investors are willing to believe two things. The first is that inflationary pressures are moderating, and certainly the downward dynamic on oil contributed to that conclusion. And second, that governments are going to start at least to issue fewer bonds, and that the supply in the market will adjust. So that was really one of the primary reasons why bond prices were trending downwards from August of last year. I think it was less about the expectation that we were about to have massive inflation and more about the fact that there was just a lot of bonds being printed, and it was a case of indigestion in the market that there just simply were not enough of buyers, so they were demanding a higher yield. But it's the commonality that we see in the market right now, because gilt prices were higher, bund prices were also up in a dynamic manner. And if we just look at the front month contracts for these bonds, well, Treasury futures were up at new recovery highs, and there's been a clear sequence of higher reaction lows since the end of March. So bond yields now are coming right back into the region of the 200-day moving average. And it does beg the question whether this area is going to represent an area of resistance. A 6.5 basis point contraction is a significant decline. So it's suggesting at least that there is the potential that inflationary pressures are going to be less pressing. Now, obviously, there are, and of course, then there's the additional point that the services sector in the USA disappointed expectations in here today. And that suggests that we are coming, or we're probably less close to the end of extraordinary monetary policy. Now, stock markets, they didn't respond particularly well to this kind of news, and the S&P 500 was in negative territory, but well off the lows as we come into the close in here today. And the bigger picture here is that if bond prices are recovering, then that's reasonably benign. It suggests that investors are at least willing to buy at the current yield. But the bigger picture is that yield curve spreads as a result are going to contract. So this, I think, is perhaps less appreciated by investors. When we think about the normal cycle, then we get these inversions, and they are very good lead indicators for future trouble and recessions. And generally speaking, the worst of the selling pressure occurs as the spread trades up through 50 basis points and trends higher. So, when we think about, for example, in the early 2000s, the bulk of the selling pressure occurred in 2000 and through to 2002. In 2006, we had the yield curve spread bottoming, and then it started to really trend higher in an aggressive manner through 2007 and all the way through to the and it was all the way up to almost the peaks by July of 2009. So when the yield curve spread started to accelerate higher from at the beginning of this year and all the way through to that peak in April of 2021. Well, when we think about what's going on here, what this suggests is that the bond yield is coming back down, or and then that is compressing the yield curve spread. So generally, we get recoveries in stocks after the peaks. So there's a realistic possibility that this is the peak, because we're at an extraordinary point, and it may be closer to the kind of trouble we had after the savings and loan crisis, and the yield curve did not get back up to these levels that we've seen over the course of the last 30 years. And perhaps we're going more into this kind of environment. It's worth considering that there was a big dollar bear market in the mid-80s, and the yield curve spread did not get back up towards the upper side of that range. And Then we had it compressing again, and we had a very significant rebound after the crash in 1987, which took us into a negative yield curve spread environment. So generally, when these spreads contract, well, it's supportive to asset prices. So there is an argument here that what we are now in fact looking at is the potential that we're moving into a bubbly environment, and that this bubble will inflate more than anyone is willing to give credence to at the present time. And eventually we'll get an inverted yield curve again, and then that will be another lead indicator for future problems, because the potential is that because services are still not firing, or I guess that's the wrong word, because the last thing they're doing is firing people, but that services sector is not recovering as quickly as people might like, and they're having difficulty hiring people, and we still have these uncertainties about the global supply chain. Well, that suggests that it will be a while before central banks can normalize policy. And whatever about normalizing policy, the first thing they're going to have to normalize is debt issuance. And after that, they can start thinking about raising interest rates and normalizing the money supply and interest rates overall. We're nowhere near that. And the sensitivity of government finances to bond prices is extraordinarily high. So it's not like they have a choice. They simply can't raise interest rates until they have clear and convincing trends of both growth and inflation. And until that is the case, there is just no prospect of interest rate hikes coming anytime soon. So that is supportive of stock markets generally. So when we then think about the International Beauty Contest and where are going to be the most attractive assets, well, it's hard to look past large cap growth, because Amazon was able to break on the upside in here today. It was the leading advancer on the NASDAQ 100, and that is a clear breakout from a well-defined range. And we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside as long as that breakout holds. So the news, of course, on the back of that was that, well, interest rates are reasonably controlled, and then we also have the fact that the government contract that Microsoft had got has now going to be split, so there will be equal benefits for both Amazon and Microsoft from the JEDI program. But this is an emphatic breakout. Then we can also look at the fact that Google continues to power ahead, and it remains in a clear uptrend, really quite consistent with a series of ranges, one above another. But there's no questioning that the pace of the advance has picked up in the last year. So it's increasingly putting in a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean, although it's a steep but consistent uptrend overall. When we think about growth, well, there are large cap growth companies in China too, and DiDi was down over 20% in here today. And when we think about why, well, it looks like, and I'm not sure whether this is a term that everybody understands, but in Ireland you would call it pulling a fast one. SoftBank had really been burned by the bankruptcy of WeWork, so they have been really anxious to IPO a significant number of the companies they've positions in, and DiDi was certainly one of those. They own over 20% of the company. So the Chinese authorities told DiDi not to go for an IPO before the Communist Party centenary celebrations last week, and they did it anyway. And it's likely And it's looking increasingly likely that it was SoftBank and Uber pressured them into doing it. So the company was able to raise about $4.5 billion from the IPO, and they've attained a valuation of about $75 billion. And the reality is that they probably got it in over the line. The Communist Party in China does not want any more US listings for its companies. And they are additionally, and I think this is really only the only conclusion that we can draw, they have determined that any data that is attained within China is government property. So they have basically made data a commodity, and they are now appropriating it. So any data-heavy company now has clear limits on their growth. So while large cap growth continues to surprise on the upside with in the USA and benefits from lower yields overall, that's unlikely to be the case for Chinese companies. So SoftBank is taking a hit because of the downtrend in shares like DiDi, but the reality is that they were able to get cash in the bank. And when we think about what the outlook is for some of the most successful companies in China, well, they remain under pressure. Tencent has been trending downwards now for most of this year. It was a little steadier in here today, but it is trading below the trend mean, and this is relevant for the wider emerging markets sector. The vast majority of people who are investing in emerging markets do so via these broad-based ETFs, and they look on these as factor investing. So when they want to buy emerging markets, they just go off and buy the MSCI index. But MSCI emerging markets is extraordinarily heavily weighted by Chinese companies, and China's Communist Party has no interest in supporting asset prices. And certainly, we can see that in shares where investors have reached the conclusion that there is clear state support, then they continue to do reasonably well. So, Kuaichao Muotai is certainly steady in the region of the trend mean. And there is nobody going out and saying that they have intellectual property that the Communist Party wants to make use of. The kinds of sectors that will do well are those that are significantly benefiting from state sponsorship. So that's certainly the case with the semiconductor sector because it's a national priority. So these types of companies are not going to be allowed to fail, because they're going to have successive rounds of liquidity poured into them. And that, I think, is likely to be what we can anticipate going forward. So then we can think about the fact that because the wider market is desperate for economic recovery, and there won't be any significant declines in liquidity, then that should be beneficial overall for commodities. But since commodity prices are correcting right now, it's probably going to take some time to translate into additional upside for commodity-related markets. Copper prices were well off their high in here today. Gold, having initially rallied, was pretty much unchanged on the day, but still up on the day overall. I think that the reality is that if we just simply think about what the correlations have been, well, gold and bond prices peaked at almost the same day in August. So it is rational, if that correlation is going to remain in place, then gold should be rallying with the bond prices. It's only a matter of time before people finally begin to understand that there is the clear intention of governments to try and devalue their currencies. So right now, the dollar continues to rebound, and it got an additional shot in the upside today because of that demand for bonds. So this is still a short-term recovery overall, but at the same time, there's no clear intention and no plan as to how the debt is going to get paid down, and we're likely to remain in this very liquid environment for at least the foreseeable future. So it is hard to argue with why the dollar should be rallying, except for the fact that the Delta variant of the coronavirus is spreading internationally. And at the present time, both the USA and the UK are coming out ahead. So that is supporting their currencies. So this is simply an example of the currency trade that has been going on for most of the last 18 months, that whichever country is coming out ahead in terms of the fight against the coronavirus sees their currency appreciate. And this has been certainly beneficial for Asian currencies last year, and it's beneficial for the dollar right now. But these are short to medium term trends, whereas the, I think, longer term trend is for the dollar to depreciate. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.